The recurring cycle of economic booms followed by inevitable busts has remained a puzzle for generations of observers. While mainstream Keynesian and monetarist theories propose monetary interventions to smooth these fluctuations, the Austrian school offers a compelling and alternative perspective. The best in Bitcoin made audible. I am Guy Swan, and this is Bitcoin Audible. What is up, guys? Welcome back to Bitcoin Audible. I am Guy Swan, the guy who has read more about Bitcoin than anybody else you know. And I want to start today off with an announcement. I have been trying to get my systems and my back end in order. This show has largely been just a really fun hobby of mine. I did it for a long time before it was actually looked like it could be profitable. And I've done it by myself for, literally until just 5 months ago, maybe. And I feel like in my attempt to change my systems and get things in order, I've really dropped the ball in a lot of ways. And one of those ways has been inconsistent episodes. And so I just wanted to make it known that we are going to be publishing on Monday, Wednesday, and Friday every single week. That is my goal, and I want you guys to hold me to it. I am determined to turn this into a real business such that it's systematized enough that I can bring someone on and just kind of plug them into the way things work. Because I've realized what a disaster it is. It's like one of those things that your desk is really messy, but you know where everything is. But if you tried to bring someone in to operate on your desk, they'd be like, what in the hell is going on? That has been this show for a long time. And I want to shout out to Mark Mariah for helping me out with kind of my perspective and getting me to realize how I need to think about this and what I need to change. And I think it's going to mean not only great things for the show, and in addition, AI Unchained, which we are going to do on Thursdays. So expect regular episodes over there as well. But more importantly, it's also going to give me a clearer way to allocate resources and get a lot of these side projects done. Because I've just been working on so many things that I'm so eager to share. And I want this show to be a really solid foundation for announcing and sharing those things out when they finally come to fruition. And with that, I would actually love your help as well. And one of the easiest things that you guys can do is leave a review and share the show. No joke, it is that easy. In fact, on Noster, because we can zap people, if you leave a review or you share the show out or any clips that you like on Fountain, tag me and I will zap you. This show has completely grown by word of mouth. I have never done any advertising, and I would much, much rather pay some sats to you guys for sharing out the shows and the episodes and the things that you like rather than paying Twitter or Facebook or Google for inserting my shit into somebody else's feed. So anyway, that was just an announcement I wanted to make. And now that we're coming up on 1,000 episodes, I think this will be a really, really awesome refocusing back on the foundation. But anyway, we have got a great one today. This is a first from author Michael Matulev, who has written a bunch of stuff on Mises, and I've been kind of slowly collecting and going through a bunch of his work. He's got a really, really great list of pieces on Mises.org. And the reason I wanted to get into this piece specifically is because he really lays out a succinct argument of why the Austrian business cycle theory of why the boom bust cycle happens. And I wanted to get into it because there's a little bit of the framing around this conversation. Not only is it like super fundamental to hit the kind of underlying structure of how and why this cycle constantly happens and how it's actually exacerbated by the very things the Keynesian monetarist theories attempt to use as an argument for why they must intervene, but also it's deeply relevant in trying to assess and making sense of what our future is and where we are in this cycle in our economy and why this bust is unavoidable. Like a lot of people I see is like, oh, we're gonna grow our way out of this. And I think it's a misunderstanding of what the bust actually is And that a lot of what people say is the way we're going to get out of it is actually the reason it's going to get worse. It actually works against it because it's a deflationary problem for the debt. So I'll get into that in the commentary afterward, but I want to let Michael, and shout out to Michael, by the way, he's a audionaut and is constantly, I see him sharing out stuff on the show, and he's always making like great comments and posts and things in Fountain. And he's seriously got a pretty awesome body of work that he has put together at Mises.org. So definitely check him out. I will have the link in the show notes to his Mises page and his Twitter account so you can follow him. Oh, also the Noster Pub Key, by the way. This show is brought to you by Nodeless.io, CoinKite.com, and the Fold app. Nodeless is the easiest way to accept Bitcoin online with no KYC, no fuss, no channel management, nothing like that, except Bitcoin and Lightning, and it will get sent directly to your cold storage in all of the ways that you want to accept it online. CoinKite makes some of the best and most trusted hardware security devices in the Bitcoin space. So where you will get your Nodeless sats sent to is directly to your cold card hardware wallet, because then you know you own it and you know it's safe. And then lastly, where you still have to use fiat, use the Fold debit card. You will get sats back on practically everything that you do, and the gift cards right in the app give you even more sats back. It is one of the lowest barrier ways to constantly be stacking sats. Check them all out with special links. There's some free sats. There's a 9% discount on the cold card. All sorts of great stuff right there in the show notes. With that, let's get into today's article. And it's titled, The Inevitable Bust: Why Economic Booms Contain the Seeds of Their Own Destruction. Written by Michael Matulev. The recurring cycle of economic booms followed by inevitable busts has remained a puzzle for generations of observers. While mainstream Keynesian and monetarist theories propose monetary interventions to smooth these fluctuations, the Austrian school offers a compelling and alternative perspective. Austrian business cycle theory provides a profound understanding of how artificially inflated booms sow the seeds of their own destruction. Delving into the depth of this theory illuminates the inherently unstable nature of economic upswings driven by the availability of cheap credit and inflation. The core of the theory: artificial booms lead to busts. The Austrian business cycle theory argues that efforts to artificially suppress interest rates below natural market levels fuel an unsustainable economic boom. When the inflationary credit expansion inevitably slows, the facade of illusory prosperity unravels as the widespread malinvestments and errors made during the boom are exposed and must be corrected. This bust phase acts as an unavoidable period of painful but necessary realignment and market correction. In contrast to mainstream beliefs that monetary authorities can successfully iron out business cycles via interventionist policy, the Austrian school of thought recognizes such efforts to stimulate growth as inherently counterproductive and ultimately destructive. Inflationary booms inevitably sow the seeds of their own destruction and systemic collapse. Fear the booms, not the busts. How credit expansion fuels the boom. The cycle begins when central banks artificially force interest rates below their natural market level, disconnecting the cost of credit from genuine consumer time preferences and real resource availability. Artificially low rates strongly incentivize increased investment spending and highly speculative borrowing fueled by easy access to cheap debt. Businesses are thus induced to embark on new projects that would normally be entirely unprofitable under rationally higher financing costs. This surge of malinvestment driven by inflationary credit creation leads to overexpansion in various sectors, driving up asset prices and further feeding the frenzy of the boom mentality. In this way, tampering with interest rates profoundly disrupts the critical balance between savings and investment in the real economy. The volume of investments funded by inflationary credit creation far outstrips the pool of real savings available. This leaves the boom without firm foundations, as monetary inflation creates an illusory mirage of prosperity. The seeds of collapse quietly take root under the surface during the boom years. Malinvestment and distorted price signals. A key insight of Austrian theory centers on malinvestment driven by severely distorted price signals. This tendency is neatly illustrated by the Misesian fable of the master builder. In an undistorted free market, the builder would objectively assess the profitability of potential construction projects based on market interest rates. High rates reflect genuinely scarce capital for long-term investments, signaling that only the most essential, profitable projects should commence. This disciplined analysis anchors investment to actual consumer demands, ensuring efficient allocation of scarce resources to sustainable endeavors. With artificially lowered rates, however, the builder believes capital is abundant and need not be conserved. Embarking on multiple concurrent, highly ambitious projects seems reasonable given the cheap credit. However, in reality, capital remains just as scarce, contrary to the illusion of easy money. As work commences on a plethora of expansive projects simultaneously, this reality manifests when the builder literally runs out of bricks, concrete, and other materials. This parable mirrors how inflationary booms drive widespread malinvestment across the country, funding countless speculative ventures based merely on the distorted price signal of cheap credit, rather than genuine consumer demands and resource availability. The turning point, when illusion meets reality. Eventually, the credit expansion fueling the artificial boom decelerates, and interest rates rise back to natural levels that reflect actual resource scarcity. The monetary illusion fades away as grim economic realities reemerge from their slumber. Investments justified solely by cheap money begin to fail without their inflationary propellant, exposing their underlying unprofitability. Speculative bubbles pop as expectations of endless monetary expansion confront reality. The economy initiates its long-delayed convalescence by finally purging the accumulated distortions and excesses seeded throughout the boom. Reconsider the master builder, who mistakenly initiated multiple grandiose projects based on the artificially low rates. As interest rates rise again, he soon finds his expansive visions are no longer financially viable. The illusion of easy profits is shattered as economic fundamentals reassert themselves. Likewise, the economy discovers countless unprofitable ventures and erroneous investments that had appeared deceptively viable under distorting monetary conditions. The house of cards crumbles as realities set in. The bust, necessary and unavoidable. According to Austrian theory, systematically liquidating the unsound investments and errors made under the influence of monetary illusion is an unavoidable correction. To blindly blame the bust for exposing the economy's excesses is akin to blaming the hangover rather than the intoxication. The distortions of the boom must be purged and the errors corrected. Seeking to prevent the bust via renewed inflationary stimulus is much like avoiding sobriety after an unrestrained bender. The necessary correction will only grow more severe if continually postponed and amplified by additional distortions that keep fundamentally unsound ventures artificially alive. The recession serves as the natural corrective phase, aimed at reestablishing a foundation of sound economic principles following the prior era of misguided optimism induced by artificial credit expansion. The bust plays an essential role in eliminating monetary distortions by realigning prices, closing unprofitable enterprises, and redirecting wasted resources into sectors genuinely aligned with consumer demands, rather than allocated based on temporary monetary inflation. This painful but necessary process clears the way for balanced, sustainable growth founded on a framework of reality, rather than fiscal intoxication and inflationary misallocation. Policymakers often deride recessions as the source of economic problems, an attempt to artificially resuscitate the economy via renewed inflation. Yet according to Austrian theory, the bust is in fact the solution, not the problem itself. The true problem was the extensive distortions and malinvestment induced by the artificial boom. Efforts to continuously reinflate bubbles through monetary intervention only worsen matters enormously and plant the seeds for far more chaotic crises in the future, when the correction is finally allowed to fully run its course. Lessons for today. Austrian business cycle theory carries several critical implications that remain highly relevant today. First, it reveals how inflationary booms plant the seeds of future busts by massively distorting investment incentives and price signals economy-wide. When interest rates are artificially lowered, malinvestment spreads rapidly across all sectors, initiating unsustainable projects that lack real underlying profitability. Second, the theory demonstrates that the subsequent bust is unavoidable and results directly from the distortions, malinvestment, and overconsumption inherent in the preceding boom. The bust is the necessary market correction to the artificial boom. This implies that policymakers cannot possibly prevent recessions by reinflating busts with even more credit and stimulus, as this will only pile new distortions upon old ones. Third, the theory shows that there are no shortcuts around the bust. Liquidation of malinvestment and realignment of the production structure are necessary to restore the economy to stability and sustainable growth. An additional stimulus cannot circumvent this painful but curative process. Fourth, the bust should be embraced or permitted to run its course as the economy's natural healing process, not derided as the problem itself. The bust is the solution to, not the cause of, economic turbulence. Finally, the Austrian framework proves that policies that aim to continually inflate booms inevitably cause tremendous harm. Cheap credit distorts pricing signals and incentives, leading to systemic misallocation of resources. These lessons remain highly pertinent in the present day, as decades of ultra-easy money have possibly inflated the largest asset bubble in modern history. Policymakers face continued pressure to reflate the bubble to avoid economic fallout. Yet Austrian theory offers a stark warning that market forces cannot be ignored perpetually. Artificially stimulated booms only set the stage for even harsher busts when the unavoidable correction finally culminates. Therefore, understanding the seeds of collapse inherently embedded in inflationary booms provides urgent insight into our precarious economic trajectory. Despite its political unpopularity, the economic downturn remains an inescapable presence on our journey, a path lined with reckless enthusiasm and the false promise of easily accessible credit. If you are listening to this show and you have a product, a service, a store, whatever it is, and you don't accept Bitcoin, then you are doing a massive disservice to the Bitcoin space. And I know at some points it can feel like it's just going to be really hard to integrate, or it's going to be really hard to start accepting, and it just isn't. If you use nodeless.io with my link /guy, nodeless.io/guy, you can literally just try it. Just start using it. The ability to say, I accept Bitcoin, and to do it without any hassle. I know you have a hardware wallet. I know you have some sort of main wallet that you use, whether it's your cold storage or you have a mobile wallet that you're a fan of. It doesn't matter. You can set up Nodeless in a matter of minutes. Plug it into WooCommerce on your online store or however it is that you want to do it. You immediately are accepting Bitcoin and Lightning, and you don't have to manage anything. You just stick in an address for it to withdraw to, and it will automatically be sent to you. Creating the Bitcoin economy literally starts with you. And one of the most important things that we can do is provide value and accept Bitcoin for our services and products. If Bitcoin is what you want to have, then demand it. Nodeless is the quick, easy way to have no KYC, uncompromised Bitcoin that does not put your identity or your personal information at risk, sent directly to you, accepted through your business. Check them out at bitcoinaudible.com/guy. All right. So the reason I really wanted to hit this piece is because, like I said, Michael has a lot of great posts on a lot of different economic topics around this and Bitcoin in particular. But I feel like I haven't hit the kind of boom and bust concept in quite a while. And there's so much talk about like whether or not we're going to have a recession and all this noise regarding the economy and where we are and whether or not we're going to just boom our way out of this with like a production explosion. I think kind of misses the point of what the fundamental problem is when we're talking about the bust. And I think Jeff Booth, if you've read Price of Tomorrow and you've been on the fence about what the outcome of a lot of this stuff is, I think it's important to read that one again because it does such a good job of laying out the deflationary problem of our debt system. And you know what Michael breaks down in this piece is the fact that the boom, when the boom is explicitly made artificial, when like, this is so funny too. Like Keynesians make all these claims about what manipulating the interest rate does, or about what their price controls can quote unquote do for the economy. And one of the things that they always say is it spurs investment, like it boosts the economy and it allows you to grow faster. When the reality is that it just creates unsustainable growth. It simply leverages the future. It leverages future capital and future consumption to be done today in an artificial way that inevitably has to bust. So a good example is that an analogy that I've used in the past, and I used in the debate with the Fed rep and the first bank. I don't know. I forget what the name of the bank was. I can't remember. And I wish I had a good copy of this. The audio and video of this is literally terrible. And I've tried really, really, really hard to make this usable. I could not get the Whisper AI to pull out anything, even like any decent version of a transcript. It was like 50% wrong. Like it was really bad. So I don't know if I'm going to be able to recover this, and I'm going to talk to a couple other people that I saw at least filming with their phone from time to time, and that would have been better. I really wish I had let the inner filmmaker in me give a backup. I wish I had been very serious about this, because I knew when I went in and I kind of saw the setup, I was like, maybe there's something here that I'm missing, and I should have just filmed it myself. But regardless, this is an analogy that I like to use because I think it does such a good job of illustrating why the boom is artificial and why the bust is inevitable. But let's say the economy has created enough lumber, nails, you know, OSB, house wrap, shingles, everything. We have enough resources to build 10 houses. And obviously, we want those numbers to be better. Like, wouldn't it be great if we could build 15? Wouldn't it be great if we could build 20? Sure, that would be wonderful. But we have to produce in order to consume. No consumption leads production. It's not possible. It is axiomatically a result. You can never eat a cake before you get the ingredients together and bake the damn thing. And fundamentally, this is what all of government intervention is attempting to do. And what's funny is because the interest rate is literally the price of time, it's the price of capital across time, then when you see a price control in like something like bread or chicken or anything that's like an immediate consumptive good at the end of the production line, well, then those supply mishaps or mismatches, the misallocation of resources is almost instantly visible, right? If you price control the price of bread down to 10 cent, we just run out of bread in no time. And the supply would absolutely crater because no one would even be able to make bread profitably. You've done price controls and you've eviscerated the balance between supply and demand. Now, that is because it's an end product. So it's very quick and easy to see. When you manipulate the price of time, it is explicitly something that only shows up as time passes. You've stolen those resources from the future because that is what the interest rate means. It's the cost of consuming capital today at the cost of its production in the future. So the problem, the supply-demand mismatch, literally doesn't show up until the future. So a microcosm of this is the example of having just enough materials to build 10 houses. Well, then what should happen is that the market economy, it's so hard, there's no like direct label anywhere. Nobody's like tallying exactly how many resources we have. It's literally an impossible task. The economy is so widespread, so multifaceted and dynamic that the singular mechanism we have to make sense of what the value and supply mismatch is of those resources is the price. It's the market price. That's it. So the market price of borrowing those resources in order to make houses, i.e. the interest rate, the rate of capital rental, is the one thing that is supposed to keep that in check, to make sure that we don't start 11 houses when we only have the production and resources necessary to build 10 of them. So what happens when we artificially lower that rate, when we price control the interest rate below the market rate? We get a massive mismatch in what is available versus what projects and expenditures we create to start, to use up those resources. And thus, we start building 20 houses, even though we only have 10 houses worth of real resources in order to finish. But politicians are so short-term minded, and they don't give a crap what happens after they get out of office. If we're talking about a debt cycle that's 10 years, nobody cares. There's not a president in the world that will give up their presidency, those great metrics that they can point to that show that they were the best president ever, if it's not going to be until after their second term that the real pain is felt. Awesome. That's more perfect than you could possibly wish for. It means that the other color is likely to be blamed for all the problems. At least it will be somebody else. The incentive is universally to let the short term look as good as possible at the cost of the long term. Every single time. There is never a time in which a politician is going to give a shit about 10 years out. And it doesn't even matter. They don't even really have the choice. And because of that, they're going to try to make as much apparent growth in the short term as possible. So when they manipulate the interest rates down, when they create this artificial boom, they get to blast out, look at our charts, look at our GDP, look at all this great data. And the GDP is, again, like not a health metric. It is not a quality metric. An economy that goes from 1x leveraged to 10x leveraged has a massively, massively growing GDP. But it is also an economy that is insanely fragile and doomed to lose a 9x. It is not a healthy economy and it is not real growth. Just like starting to build 20 houses when you only have 10 houses worth of resources does not mean that we get 20 houses. It means that we waste years of people's time. We waste tons of gray capital that would have gone towards healthcare, would have gone towards education. We steal all of this value away from these other endeavors and get them all to become contractors and real estate agents for houses that will literally never even be finished. Before that short period, while everybody's building the first 20% or 40% of those 20 houses, everything looks phenomenal. Stats are through the roof. Keynesians look like geniuses. But what happens when we're about 50% away through those houses? Prices start to really, really go up. And it turns out all the financing that tried to make those houses happen actually isn't sustainable. And now they can't even afford to finish the houses because they can't get the resources. And at the end of the day, the price is correct. Everything starts to slow down, and a 10x leverage, that's the thing, is that the leverage only works during the growth phase. As soon as you get off that bicycle, as soon as you're standing still, the entire thing collapses because you can only sustain more leverage with growth. It makes the economy insanely fragile. The first hint of things slowing down or getting bad causes the entire thing to unravel. But the simple fact is, you can't build 20 houses with 10 houses worth of resources. And what's funny is if we had just limited the growth, if we had allowed the economy to regulate how much was actually sustainable, then we would have just had 10 more houses at the end of that time period. Instead, not only do we not have 20 houses, we have 20 half houses. And it's not as if we can just cancel 10 of them and then go back to having 10. Instead, we have to like cancel 15, 18 of them because the resources can't even be allocated quickly enough to adjust back to finish the 10 houses that were actually sustainable. So you get an artificial boom, a boom that was outsized versus what we actually had available to us, and then a bust that is outsized past what could have actually been if we had just not f***ed with everything. And this is another thing that Lynn Alden does such a good job of breaking down in her book, Broken Money, because she really does a good job of steel-manning the Keynesian argument and explaining why it seems to make sense, because there are cycles. There is a cyclical ebb and flow of the economy, just like we have seasons, we have, you know, like everything is about trying to soften things. The entire system of the economy, the idea of speculation, of being able to hedge and, you know, write futures contracts and all of these things, they actually have a genuine purpose in the economy, and it's to smooth out the variation between the production and the provision of the end products and services of the economy. So like there's literally harvest season and then there is winter. So the fact that cotton and a lot of these resources are actually consistent in price across those is the job of the economy, is the job of the pricing system to allocate resources to encourage someone who is getting a lot of cotton for cheap at one time in the year to sell it for a slightly higher price at a later time in the year in order to even out those differences, to take those resources across time from when they are abundant to when they are scarce. And the Keynesians and the monetarist theorists, the government interventionists, always make the argument of like, look at these ebbs and flows, look at these fluctuations. Well, we can actually fix all of this by running a deficit when things are tough and then running a surplus when things are great. We can slow down the boom and we can prop up the bust. When in reality, there's two huge problems with this. One is that the pricing system is the allocation for telling us whether or not we have a boom or a bust, whether or not we're in a misallocated period or things are properly balanced and sustainable, which means that you're manipulating the very thing that you must react to. It's like using the thermometer to gauge what action you should take while manipulating the thermometer in order to get the results you want. All you've done is discredit, all you've done is diminish what actual signal the thermometer is telling you. You can now no longer rely on it because you are manipulating it. But in addition to that extremely fundamental problem to the very mechanisms we have to make sense of where we are in such a cycle, the other big problem is that there's no political incentive to ever make things harder. That's what they're saying, that they're going to diminish the boom, that while the economy is growing, they're going to deliberately make all of their statistics look worse. This supposed policy of theirs has never been anything but the deficit side. The way Lynn Alden puts it in her book is that what ends up happening is that during good times, they run deficits, and during bad times, they run really bad deficits. I mean, how many decades? I mean, the better part of half a century or more that they do the exact opposite of what they claim is going to help the economy, and we have this progressive, compounding, never-ending deficit problem. At what point do we actually look at what they actually did instead of the horseshit that they feed us when they get on the podium to tell us how great they are and all of the things that they did were perfect, and the only thing that ever went wrong was that people are stupid and the free market ruined all of their plans? No, sir, your failure to understand anything about economics or the free market is why all of your plans sucked and they all failed miserably. And so back to Michael's point in this article and why I think it's so important to remember that a bust has to come is that when we're talking about quote-unquote producing our way out of this, we have to separate genuine production and genuine growth from the GDP. Because I think people don't realize that we can have genuine quality and economic growth where GDP does not go up. GDP is largely a metric that responds to the increase in the money supply, whether it is directly printing money or loaning more money than exists. It is a completely self-fulfilling metric for the government system, and it's because we don't have a genuine metric of growth outside of it if they're manipulating the economy. So they created GDP. It's insane. The entire modern world, the globe, uses GDP as a metric, which is not a healthy metric of growth. I swear to God, I don't know how many times I have to say that. We have got to get out of this way of thinking. GDP went up in 2020. There's no more perfect example in the exact same year that 40% of small business was demolished across the United States. It is the worst year for economic stability and productivity we have probably ever had in 50 years. I don't even know. GDP went up. It is a bullshit metric. It doesn't measure anything. It is a facade. It is just a magic wand horseshit indicator that the government has made up so that whatever they do, it literally just responds to the things that government does. It doesn't mean real growth. GDP was wonderful in 2005, 2006, and 2007, and then it was dog shit in 2008 and 2009. Why? Because it wasn't real. GDP was telling us nothing meaningful about what was going on. It was measuring the leverage that we had to unwind. It was measuring the boom without making any sort of understanding or lending any visibility whatsoever into the bust that had to follow. And I swear to God, everybody's like, who's going to caveat and defend GDP? It's like, oh, well, it's not perfect. No, it's shit. I don't care where you think it works. If it said we went up in 2020, it's broken and there is no fixing it. It's a bad metric. It needs to be thrown in the trash. If you lost a piston in your engine and your alternator broke and your car indicated across the board that all sensors were go and everything was fine, then you need to throw away those sensors and replace them with something that works. And I don't care what time of day that it actually works, where it does happen to line up, where the alternator is working and the engine is working and the car says everything's working. A broken clock is right twice a day. That is not an argument for the fact that it is accurately telling you time. So in the context of where we are today, in this cycle, we are seeing the results, we are seeing the bill come due of a long-term debt cycle where every artificial boom and bust has been papered over. Where, you know, going back to the example of only having 10 years worth of, or 10 houses worth of resources, and you try to start 20 houses, well, understand that that would actually come to fruition. We would actually realize that imbalance far, far faster than, because it's such a small economy with a small mismatch of resources across time. And we're talking about projects that take 6 months, right, to build a house. Well, what happens when we're talking about long-term manufacturing? We're talking about building chip manufacturing and plants in the United States that take 20 years to come to fruition, 10 years, like long-term plans for energy that depend on other plans that are 5 to 10 year plans, where somebody has to build a hospital, where somebody has to build some sort of major infrastructure thing in order to account for the energy that's being built, or vice versa, where the energy has to be built in order to house some huge facility or manufacturing plant, that these things are dependent on each other, that one must come after the other, and they're all operating based on resources that they don't even know exist, and we're doing this across trillions of interactions, across years and years of trying to match the resources to the actual production and the consumption. And you have foreign entities, you have foreign governments and nations and populations that you can pull those resources from. If you have a currency that's the global reserve currency, well, you can actually export your imbalance, where what you do is you price out your own manufacturing and you gut your manufacturing base out of your country, but you can pull in all of the consumption, you can export it to other nations. You can get China to just fund all of your cheap products and continue to boost up your consumption. The length of time that these imbalances can go on, especially if you have massive foreign demand for your currency, for the very thing that is causing, that you're manipulating in order to cause this boom-bust cycle, you can continue to leverage up as long as that demand stays there, as long as that foreign demand. And what's funny is everybody is doing it, and your currency has the largest network. then inevitably you can just do it for longer and you can make it bigger. But the leverage has to unwind. And the reason I don't think it's accurate to say, and maybe I'm missing something, but we can't produce our way out of this. Granted, that is our only solution, but you can't produce your way out of the deleveraging. Because when you produce, when you actually, you genuinely grow the economy, it's deflationary to the currency, which means that all of the debts get worse, not better. So the only thing aggressive production will do, like massive real growth will do, is essentially help to defend the cost of the inflation as much as possible. But the inflation is a compounding problem. The deficit is a compounding problem. I mean, we have hit and I think are soaring past now at a ridiculous rate over $1 trillion in just in interest payments. I don't think people realize how quickly that can become $2 trillion and then $3 trillion. The doublings come faster and harder as this gets worse. And we're doing it while the Fed is aggressively raising interest rates. And treasury bonds, the yields on treasury bonds are increasing and still not meeting buyers. And this coincides with when those interest rates start to reveal which projects weren't legitimately profitable. This is so important to understand, is that because, and Michael breaks this down in this piece really well, that he says, quote, with artificially lowered rates, however, the builder believes capital is abundant and need not be conserved. Embarking on multiple concurrent, highly ambitious projects seems reasonable given the cheap credit. However, in reality, capital remains just as scarce, contrary to the illusion of easy money. So it's not just that more of the same projects are engaged in, it's higher risk and more absurd projects that would be obviously not profitable. They're only expected to make 2 or 3% gains when the cost of capital is legitimately 7% of 8 or 8%, but it's been artificially lowered to 1%. Well, then we can actually engage in projects that not only can't be finished because of the sheer lack of resources available to finish them, but even if they do get finished, they're not even going to be net profitable over the time it takes to produce them. They're literally going to destroy 4%, 5% of the capital that they use, and what their end product is isn't even sustainable. So it's not until the interest rates come back that we actually halt these projects, that this poisonous capital use is finally deleted. And understand that you can't like control the economy from doing this. Everything has to respond to price signals. You can't say like people shouldn't do something ambitious or stupid or risky when everything about the price signal is saying this is viable, do this. It's like making the price of oranges, inflating the price of oranges like 1,000% so that all oranges are sold for like $300 an orange, and then say demanding by like some law or executive order that nobody knew can grow a tree and pick oranges and sell oranges. That shit's never gonna work. You've caused the very problem. Like you can't possibly stop people from selling oranges if you have so grossly manipulated the price. And it's such a fundamental imbalance that that's just the only way that anybody can get by. You've stacked the cards against them such that the responsible thing to do is going to take net losses, is actually going to hurt the people who invest in it. Frugal and responsible behavior isn't just diminished, it's literally punished. They're the ones who pay for this irresponsible behavior. And it's even worse when they should actually get the correction, they actually should get the prices returned, and they should get their interest rates back to some sort of sustainable level and be rewarded, and then they just bail out the entire system. They just paper over all of the leverage so that the irresponsible behavior gets bailed out and the frugal and responsible never get their day. They never get the opportunity to actually buy up the resources and reallocate based on the proper decisions and proper behavior. So you create this culture of irresponsible, corrupt bullshit. You just create an entire financial system of gamblers who have no idea what's going on and are so divorced from genuine long-term investment and capital allocation, and just becomes a bunch of VC bros chasing the highest green candles wherever the hell they can find it. Which always just ends up being in the thing that you can hype the fastest and get enough newly printed debt to fuel, and then they can get out as quick as they possibly can. That's why it's so massively flooded into crypto, because it's the epitome of don't have to produce anything, don't have to have any long-term investment, can get in and get out with a profit as fast as possible, and who gives a shit if it actually builds anything? If that's the, quote, investment that the government is incentivizing, it's not investment. It's not. It has nothing to do with building real capital. And it's entirely because of the manipulation of the price of debt. Going back to the article, quote, eventually, the credit expansion fueling the artificial boom decelerates, and interest rates rise back to natural levels that reflect actual resource scarcity. The monetary illusion fades away as grim economic realities reemerge from their slumber. Investments justified solely by cheap money begin to fail without their inflationary propellant, exposing their underlying unprofitability. And that leads to one of the most important things that this article hits and that I try to talk about on this show, is that the bust is actually the most important part of that cycle, because it is the correction. It is the cutting of the fat and the punishing of the irresponsible behavior and the leverage that was unsustainable, so that it disincentivizes us from doing it again. If we have wasted $1 trillion on unprofitable endeavors, the best way to fix and heal the economy is to let that $1 trillion be cut out as fast as possible, sold at fire sale prices to the few people who actually had savings, and restructured into useful, profitable endeavors. Genuine creation of value and capital that everyone literally needs to survive and to make our lives better. Just aggressively lowering interest rates and printing money just reinforces all of the problems that got us to the issue, to the bust. And the problem is that because we are the global reserve currency, this can get worse and worse and worse until the global reserve status, the very nature, the very value of our currency itself is fundamentally threatened by this entire apparatus. It literally just grows bigger and bigger and bigger until the entire thing snaps in half. And for the people who say that, you know, this time, you know, we've done all this before, right? We have these cycles and we raise interest rates and we lower them and, you know, et cetera, et cetera. And decrying all the, this time is different, people. Well, this time is different, literally. There's a very, very strong argument for why this is not going to work again. Certainly not at the scale nor the time period that it has pushed this off in the past. Because we've never risen interest rates while the debt to GDP is like 120%. We've never raised interest rates this fast and this much in such a short span of time. We've never done it with the lowest receipts for foreign purchases of U.S. treasuries as we have. And we've never done it after an entire decade of near 0% interest rates that has led to the largest debt bubble we have ever had. So not only is this time different, we've never had it happen. We've never had this set of conditions to deal with in isolation. Now we have all of them together at the exact same time, thinking that this is business as usual. It is not. Something has to give somewhere. Greg Foss says it best. It's just math. We cannot create 5 artificial booms, paper over the bust, and reinflate them with another huge bout of fake artificial credit, and just think that there's no time in which that bill comes due. There's another great quote from this article that I really like. It says, "Seeking to prevent the bust via renewed inflationary stimulus is much like avoiding sobriety after an unrestrained bender. The simple reality is that there will be a hangover. And I certainly do not want my money stuck in or tied to the sinking Titanic when the water really starts rushing in." This is also why I think, again, Lynn Alden posted about this recently on Noster. And also, it's a great section in her book that she talks about this, is that the fiscal problem is a monetary problem. It's a technological problem. It is not, all the systems and incentives are aligned that it is impossible to fix. There is no correction within the way things work that could actually fundamentally change, make a fundamental difference to this problem. That the fiscal problem should be completely ignored from a political standpoint because it is unfixable, and everything else should be focused entirely upon defending the monetary solution. In other words, the only solution to the fiscal deficit issue is a solution to the money. We have to fix the money before fixing the endless fiscal deficits is even on the table. And the best thing we can do for that, understand every bit of value that you keep in fiat, that you enable the demand, that you accept fiat for payment. Every time you do that, every time we do that, I still do that. I accept fiat. I am giving artificial demand to the very system that is enabling that misallocation, which is why I genuinely think of it as an obligation to get it out of fiat as fast as possible and into Bitcoin. Because we will never stop the chariot from moving forward if we don't stop pushing it. It is purely our allocation of value to it that props it up. The one and best thing that we can do is exit our value from it. Buy as much Bitcoin as we can, put it on our cold card, stick it into cold storage, accept Bitcoin for our businesses, keep our value, and do our commerce in Bitcoin so that we are not propping up this system. Now, it's not going to make any huge difference with any one of us, but collectively, the continual slow exit will both support the value of Bitcoin and diminish the liquidity and the value of the dollar. It is our only mechanism for forcing their hand. So that's why I do it. If you think you have a better solution, let me know. I'm all ears. But I do not think any of it exists within the political realm. It is too fundamental to the nature of how money works. It is at its base a credit. And if new money is issued as a credit, then it is fundamentally manipulable and there's no way around it. Especially if the only good, the thing that has to happen is specifically for all politicians to show such an absurd amount of restraint that they would let the economy be bad, they would let themselves look bad, they would fight against public opinion and explain why it was important that we held this enormous amount of restraint. They would have to be more restrained than the public in order to even begin to do the thing that needs to happen. It literally goes against every incentive of the political system, and it is too easy. It is too unbelievably politically convenient to just print money, make things appear better for the short term, ease everyone's pain, get everyone to take another shot, and just get all drunk again, and let the other guy pay for the consequences. Fixing the money is a prerequisite. That is why we Bitcoin. So anyway, we will close this one out here. Thank you guys so much for listening. Do not forget to check out Michael Matulev don't forget to check out the Mises page with all of his work and follow him on Twitter and Noster. Those links will be available right in the show notes. And of course, check out our lovely sponsors who make this show possible. We have Nodeless, the easiest way to accept Bitcoin online, CoinKite, the place to keep it safe and know that you own it, and Fold, the way to turn your fiat life into a sat stacking opportunity. The links are in the show notes. Get it, got it, good. I love you all. Thank you for listening to this show. Do not forget to subscribe. Do not forget to share this show out and leave a review on all of your favorite podcasting apps. It makes a huge difference, and I love you. And if you post it on Noster, I will shoot you 1,000 sats. I thank you, and I'll catch you on the next one. Until then, take it easy, guys. You're all humiliated by the sudden discovery of a fact which has existed very comfortably and perhaps been staring at us in private while we have been making up our world entirely without it. George Eliot.